34. Picture-perfect marsupials. Patrick Ireland was trying to learn to talk again. So frustrating. The first couple of days he couldn't manage much of anything. He struggled to spit out a single sentence, word by word, and when he had finished, it often made no sense. In his best moments, Patrick spoke like the victim of a severe stroke. Slow, labored attempts would produce a single guttural symbol, then a sudden burst of sound. He could form the words in his head, but few made the passage to his mouth. Where did all the rest go? Any chance distraction could hijack the thought as it made its way to his vocal cords. Random phrases often slipped in to replace the ideas. His mom would ask how he was feeling, and he'd answer in Spanish or recite the capitals of South American countries. His brain was never aware of the mix-up. He was sure he had just described his mood or asked for a straw and was confused by her confusion. Patrick's brain tended to spit out whatever was in short-term memory. He had been studying the capitals just before the shooting and recently returned from Spain. Often the memories were more immediate. Hospital intercom announcements were constantly echoing out of Patrick's mouth in response to unrelated questions. He had no idea he had even heard the voices in the background. Other times it was complete nonsense. Picture-perfect marsupials kept popping out. No one knows where that came from. It got frustrating for everyone. One of Patrick's first meals out of the ICU was a juicy hamburger. He was so excited about it and couldn't wait to slather the bun with something. Kathy gently asked him to repeat. That was annoying, but he answered with fresh gibberish. Over and over, he repeated himself, more angry with each new batch of nonsense. He tried miming it, shaking the bottle. He really wanted that condiment. Kathy's sister ran downstairs and got one of everything from the cafeteria. Mustard, relish, salsa, big handfuls of packets. None of that. They never did figure out what he wanted. Patrick understood that he'd been shot. He knew he had gone out the window. He didn't grasp the scale of the massacre. He didn't know he had been on TV or the television shows were interested in him. He had no idea the networks had cast him as the boy in the window. Now and then, Patrick would stammer out an intelligible answer, and it would make him extremely happy. His motor skills seemed fine on the left side. If his brain could control his left hand to work a fork, why not a pen? Someone fetched a pack of markers and a whiteboard. Oh boy, was that a mistake, Kathy recalled. Big mistake, John said. It was just scribbles, absolute. It was one thing to hear Patrick's struggle. Seeing his inability sketched out in black and white, that was a shocker. It was like a diagram of a brain malfunctioning, scads of tiny neurons misfiring randomly into nowhere. The Irelands were also confronted with the realization that the problem lay deeper than the control centers for Patrick's vocal cords. He couldn't organize the thoughts behind them. He could respond emotionally, but he could not translate that into language, regardless of the medium. It frustrated him. It scared the hell out of us, John said. He can't speak, and now he can't write. And how are we going to communicate with him? Sometimes, with a great struggle, Patrick formed the words out loud. Sometimes that posed bigger problems. The questions could be unsettling. Urgently, he begged them to tell him one thing. How long is this going to be? This? The hospital, the recovery. He didn't have time for all this. He had finals in 3 weeks. He had ski season and basketball to train for. He was totally coming into his own on the basketball court. He couldn't afford to get a B. He had gone 3 straight years without one. He had worked his ass off again all semester, and he was acing every class. The valedictorian thing was for real now, almost in reach. He wasn't about to screw it up with this hospital crap. He was going to graduate as valedictorian. It had been an ambitious goal. Patrick was a bright kid, but no genius. And Columbine was competitive. Some kids could cruise to easy A's, but Patrick had to fight for some of his. Several students with unblemished records shared the valedictory title every year. He couldn't afford even one B. The geniuses could cruise to A's without breaking a sweat. Patrick hated getting lumped in with them. So Patrick made his parents a little uneasy when he announced his intention freshman year in the car on the way to basketball practice. He didn't make a big deal out of it, and he didn't say he would try. He just said he was going to do it. 2 years later, in his hospital room, John and Kathy Ireland had let go of basketball, water skiing, and academic honors. Walking and talking sounded ambitious. The severity of his situation was more than Patrick could swallow. "I didn't really comprehend, really," he said later. Patrick Ireland did not see a television or a newspaper the first week. He didn't realize his family was protecting him or how big the Columbine tragedy was. He had no idea the whole country was watching. He didn't even know who had died. The first indication of what he was involved in came when friends called to check on him from Europe. He had gone on a class trip a month earlier and stayed with a family near Madrid. Now they were worried about him. Patrick was taken aback. They were hearing about this in Spain? 7 days out, he transferred to Craig Hospital. He began rehab and was quickly scooting around the hospital in a wheelchair. He returned from therapy one day and turned on the TV. It was the news. They were listing the people killed. They showed Corey DePooter's picture. Patrick was stunned. Corey was one of his best friends. They had started in the library together, but gotten separated when the noises first started outside, and Corey went to investigate. Patrick had never seen him since. "I started bawling," Patrick said later. "I think that was the first time I cried." The staff at Craig was not pushing for a first step, just a little movement. If he could get control of that leg and lift it up off the mattress, there was hope. His leg was fine. All the neural pathways up and down his spinal cord were intact. Signals passed unimpeded to the muscles wrapped around his femur. Millions of tiny nerve endings continued transmitting sensory data along the length of his thigh. Patrick knew, intellectually, that all that fine machinery was functional, but he couldn't reach it. There was just the tiniest little gap in the network inside his brain. Somewhere inside his head, he could feel himself issue the command. He felt it moving in there, but then it got lost. He squeezed his eyes, squeezed his brain, tried to force it. Squeezing didn't help. The leg refused. Something was missing. The makeshift memorials in Clement Park had grown enormous over the first few days. Hundreds of thousands of flowers were piled up with poems, drawings, and teddy bears. Letter jackets, jewelry, and wind chimes added sprinkles of individuality. The district rented several warehouses to store them. It wasn't enough. The survivors didn't know what they needed, or where, or why, exactly, but they needed something. They were searching for a symbol, and they knew it immediately when it came. 7 days after the massacre, shortly before sunset, a row of 15 wooden crosses rose up along the crest of Rebel Hill. They stood 7 feet high, 3 feet wide, and were spaced evenly along the length of the mesa. Clement Park's floodlights lit up the low-hanging clouds behind them, and the crosses cast an eerie silhouette against the thunderheads. The tips seemed to glow. They were startling, too, for their imperfections. The dimensions seemed a little off. The crossbeams looked far too short and were branched too close to the top. Some were planted poorly, leaning badly to one side. Within hours, the arms dangled beads, ribbons, rosaries, placards, flags, and so many blue and white balloons. Over the next 5 days, 125,000 people trekked up the hill to reach the crosses. They trudged through the mud as a vicious storm pounded the hill. They tore away the grass. Many waited 2 hours in the rain just to begin the climb. It felt like a pilgrimage. The crosses had come from Chicago. A short, pudgy carpenter built them out of pine he got at Home Depot. He drove them to Colorado in a pickup, planted them on the hill, and drove back. He taped a black and white photo of one victim or killer to each cross, and he left a pen dangling from each one to encourage graffiti. I couldn't believe how fast people came up and started putting stuff around them, an onlooker said. Soon each cross had sprouted a pile covering the base and making its way up the arms. Christian dog tags were popular, with phrases like, "God is awesome," and "Jesus lives." Several crosses were wrapped head to foot in flowers, others dressed in shirts and jackets and pants. On 13 crosses, the messages were loving and uncontroversial. The killer's crosses hosted a bitter debate. Hate breeds hate. How can anyone forgive you? "I forgive you," someone responded. Half the messages were conciliatory. "Sorry, we all failed you. No one is to blame." It was exactly as Tom and Sue Klebold had feared. If they had buried Dylan, his grave would look like that. A woman told a reporter she'd been spit on for grieving for the killers, then shoved into the mud. A woman with a baby wrote, "Evil bastard," on Dylan's cross. The crowd didn't like it. Then she wrote it again. Two teenage girls approached her. Crying, they begged her to stop. Someone began singing "Amazing Grace." Soon, much of the hillside was belting out the refrain. The woman left. The crosses ask an implicit question. Rocky Mountain News columnist Mike Litwin wrote, "Are you ready to forgive?" When I first saw the crosses and understood what they meant, I wondered if it was too soon even to ask that question. Most people wouldn't have defaced the cross, but many would have been tempted. Do those crosses defile what has become sacred ground? "Hell yes," Brian Rohrbaugh said. Just when he thought the pain couldn't get any worse, some jerk had raised a shrine to his son's murderer. Who could be that cruel? Despite the flare-ups, controversy was the exception. One woman marveled at the forgiveness in her community. How many other places would allow this and not have taken Eric and Dylan's crosses out of the ground already? She asked. Saturday's edition of The Rocky led with a three-word headline, "Dad Destroys Crosses." A haunting photo captured 13 remaining tributes with two stark gaps. Eric and Dylan's crosses had lasted 3 days. "You don't cheapen what Christ did for us by honoring murderers with crosses," Brian said. "There's nowhere in the Bible that says to forgive an unrepentant murderer. Most Christians don't know that. These fools have come out saying, 'Forgive everyone.' You don't repent. You don't forgive them. That's what the Bible says." Rohrbaugh divided the community. Some people understood his anger. Others found his response a little harsh. "People need to learn to forgive," a woman on the hill told The Rocky. But then she thought for a moment. I can understand his rage. Brian's first response was not to destroy the two crosses. He initially affixed each one with a sign saying, "Murderers burn in hell." The park district took them down. Officials said they had also removed a teddy bear smeared with ketchup and were prohibiting anything obscene. Brian conferred with his ex-wife Sue and her husband Rich Patron. They agreed to a united front on everything. Rich called several officials, Sheriff Stone, Dave Thomas, the DA, and the man in charge of the Parks Department. The three of them said those crosses shouldn't be there. "We're going to take them down. Give us until tomorrow at 5, and we promise you they'll be gone," Brian said. He and the Patrons went to the hill at 5, and nothing had happened. "So we decided, let's just go take care of this," Brian said. "We don't need to put up with this stuff." Brian wanted those symbols out, and he wanted the world to see it. He called CNN, and a crew filmed it. "It wasn't going to be done in darkness," Brian said. Brian and the Patrons hauled the crosses away, hacked them into little pieces, and then tossed the rubble into a dumpster. "We got back, and we were sitting there talking about it, and the phone rings," Brian recalled. "It was Thomas. 'Just give us a little more time.' And Rich says, 'Nope, we've already taken care of it.'" Brian took charge of his tragedy that day. He discovered the power of being Danny Rohrbaugh's dad. From that day forward, he would not hesitate to wield it. But this particular battle was just getting underway. the carpenter drove back from Chicago and pulled out the 13 remaining crosses. Now Brian Rohrbaugh was really fuming. The cruelest man of the aftermath had returned to tear down the monument to his son. Rohrbaugh also sensed opportunism. "I question his motives," he said. Brian had good instincts. The carpenter had made a family business out of similar stunts. He returned with a new set of crosses and a pack of media on his heels. The highlight was a joint appearance with Brian on the Today Show. The showman apologized profusely and offered a series of solemn vows. He would never build another cross for the killers, or for any killer, and he would drive around the country removing several he had erected in the past. He broke every promise. He built 15 new crosses and took them on a national tour. He milked his celebrity for years. Brian Rohrbaugh returned to cursing him. The opportunist, the great carpenter, the most hateful, despicable person who had come to someone else's tragedy. The world forgot the carpenter. Few had noted his name. Most never knew what a huckster he was, or the lies he told, or the pain he inflicted. But they remember his crosses fondly. They recall the comfort that they found. 35. Arrest. Eric was a thief now. He had a set of rent-a-fence signs. He liked the feeling. He wanted more. Junior year, the boys got right to work. Eric and Dylan and Zach hacked into the school computer and commandeered a list of locker combinations. They began breaking in. They got sloppy. On October 2, 1997, they got caught. They were sent to the dean, who suspended them for 3 days. The Harrison-Klebold parents responded the way they always did. Wayne Harris was a pragmatist. He would make Eric regret what he'd done. With outsiders, he was focused on containment. Eric's future was at stake. He called the dean and argued that Eric was a minor. The dean was unmoved. "What would show up on Eric's records?" Wayne asked. He jotted down the answer in his journal. "In-house only because police were not involved. Destroyed upon graduation." Good. Eric had a promising future ahead. The Klebolds addressed the situation intellectually. Dylan had demonstrated a shocking lapse of ethics, but Tom disagreed with suspensions on philosophical grounds. There were more effective ways to discipline a child. The dean had rarely met such a thoughtful, intelligent parent, but the judgment stood. Eric and Dylan were each grounded for a month and were forbidden contact with each other or with Zach. Eric also lost his computer privileges. Eric and Dylan weathered the punishment and remained close. Zach began drifting away, particularly from Eric. The tight threesome was over. From that day forward, Eric and Dylan committed their crimes as a pair. Fuselier considered Eric's psychological state at this point, a year and a half before the murders. Eric was not a depressive like Dylan, that was for sure. And there were no signs of mental illness, no signs of anything to predict murder. Eric's website was obscenely angry, but anger and young men were practically synonymous. The instincts that would lead to Columbine were surely in place by now, but Eric had yet to reveal them. Dylan fixated on Harriet. 50 minutes a day for one class period. Dylan lolled around in heaven. Harriet was in his class. Sometimes she would laugh. What a darling little laugh she let out. So innocent, so pure. Innocence. What an angelic quality. Someday, Dylan would speak to her. One day, Dylan saw his chance. He had a group project for the class, a report to work on together, and Harriet was on his team. Blessed day. This was it. He did nothing. Dylan described his trajectory as a downward spiral. He borrowed the phrase from Nine Inch Nails' gripping concept album, which documents a fictional man unraveling. It climaxes with him killing himself with a gun to the mouth. Oliver Stone's satirical film Natural Born Killers would become the pop culture artifact most associated with the Columbine Massacre. That was reasonable, since Eric and Dylan used NBK as shorthand for their own event. And the film bears considerable resemblances. It also captured the flavor of Eric's egotistical, empathy-free attitude, but it bore no relation to Dylan's psyche. It certainly wasn't where he saw his life headed, at least not until the final months. For the first 18 to 20 months of his journal, Dylan identified with two powerful characters to convey his torment, the protagonists of The Downward Spiral and David Lynch's film Lost Highway. After the murders, controversies raged about the role of violent films, music, and video games. Some columnists and talk radio hosts saw an easy cause and effect. That seemed simplistic for Eric, who was a gifted critical thinker with a voracious appetite for the classics, and absurd for his partner. Dylan identified with depressives on the brink of suicide. He focused on fictional characters mired in the hopelessness he already felt. Eric got sloppy. He allowed the worst imaginable person to discover one of his pipe bombs, his dad. Wayne Harris was beside himself. Firecrackers were one thing, but this was too much. He wasn't even sure what to do with it. Eric told several friends about the incident, and their accounts of Wayne's response varied. Zach Heckler said Wayne could not figure out how to defuse the bomb, so he went outside with Eric and detonated it. But Nate Dykeman said Wayne had merely confiscated the bomb. Sometime later, Eric took Nate into his parents' bedroom closet and showed it to him. Wayne Harris never referred to the incident in his journal on Eric, which was dormant at this time. Eric swore up and down to his parents that he would never make a bomb again. They apparently believed him. They wanted to. Eric probably shut down production for a while, and he definitely covered his tracks better. Eventually, he got back to business. At some point, he showed Nate two or three of his later products, which he was storing in his own room. Dylan felt abandoned. He was grounded for the locker scam, home alone and lonelier than ever. Then his older brother, Byron, was kicked out for drugs. Tom and Sue understood that tough love would cause an upheaval, so they went to family counseling with Dylan. That didn't change their son's outlook. He got a new room out of it, and he put his own stamp on the place, two black walls and two red ones, posters of baseball heroes and rock bands, Lou Gehrig, Roger Clemens, and Nine Inch Nails, also some street signs and a woman in a leopard bikini. "I get more depressed with each day," he complained. Why did friends keep deserting him? They did not, actually, but Dylan perceived it that way. He fretted about Eric dumping him too. "Wanna die," he repeated. Death equaled freedom now. Death offered tranquility. He began using the words interchangeably. Then he weighed the other option. He named a friend and said he will get me a gun. I'll go on my killing spree against anyone I want. It was Dylan's second allusion to murder. The first had been ambiguous. This was overt. And now it was a spree. He changed the subject immediately. That was unusual. As a rule, Dylan hammered ideas relentlessly. He would drill for two straight pages on the everlasting struggle or his destiny as a seeker. Murder was different. For the second time, he tossed in a single line at the peak of despair and promptly returned to his own destruction. The idea was germinating a year and a half out. Dylan appeared to be exploring a spree with Eric, probably. But the details of this critical moment are lost. Neither boy ever mentions those conversations and the paper trail they left behind. Eric recorded his actions. He was building bigger bombs. Coincidence? Unlikely. Eric's thinking had been evolving steadily in one direction since freshman year. Late in 1997, Eric took notice of school shooters. Every day, news broadcasts stories of students shooting students or going on killing sprees, he wrote. He researched the possibilities for an English paper. Guns were cheap and readily available, he discovered. Gun Digest said you could get a Saturday night special for $69, and schools were easy targets. It is just as easy to bring a loaded handgun to school as it is to bring a calculator, Eric wrote. Ouch, his teacher responded in the margin. Overall, he rated it thorough and logical. Nice job. The last day of school before Christmas, something extraordinary happened. Dylan's true love waved at him. Finally! Dylan was ecstatic. Then he began to wonder, had she waved? At him? Maybe not. Probably not. Definitely not. Just delusional, he decided. Again. He sat down and considered who loved him. He listed their names on a page in his journal. He drew little hearts beside them. 19 people, 19 failures. A few weeks later, Eric made it with a real woman. Brenda was almost 23. She had no idea he was 16. He acted a lot older, she said. When he told her he was in school, she took it to mean college. They met at the mall, and he drove to her house. They started going out, bowling, drag racing, driving into the mountains to get drunk. He taught her about the computer. He told her how great she looked, and she could not have been more charmed. She described it to reporters later as a friendship, but more than a friendship. Sometimes Dylan would hang out with them. He was too shy to speak. Eric and Dylan got cockier. They stole more valuable merchandise and started testing their pipe bombs. Outwardly, they seemed like responsible kids. Teachers trusted them and granted them access to the computer closet. They helped themselves to expensive equipment. At some point, Eric may have started a credit card scam. In his notebook, he listed 8 steps to complete this scam, though there's no evidence that he carried them out. He later claimed he had. Dylan was no good at deception. He kept getting caught. Eric did not. Tom Klebold noticed Dylan had a new laptop. Eric could have weaseled out of that one without missing a beat. It was a friend's. He checked it out of the computer lab. Dylan just confessed. His dad made him turn himself in.
This audiobook is continued on Disc 7. Columbine by Dave Cullen. Continued. Disc 7.
Eric and Dylan both had a penchant for picking on underclassmen, but Dylan got caught. In January 1998, he got sent to the dean for scratching a slur about fags onto a freshman's locker. He got another suspension and paid $70 to get the locker fixed. The boys were shooting off their pipe bombs by then, and man, were those things badass. They bragged to Nate Dykeman and then brought him along for a demo. Eric was in charge where bombs were concerned, so everything went according to plan. They waited until Super Bowl Sunday, when the streets of Metro Denver were deserted. The Broncos were underdogs in their 5th shot at the championship, and everyone was watching the game. Eric took advantage of the lull. He brought Nate and Dylan out to a quiet spot near his house, dropped the bomb in a culvert, and let her rip. Whoa! Nate was appropriately impressed. On January 30th, 3 days after Dylan's meeting with the dean, a crime of opportunity presented itself. It was a Friday night, and the boys were restless. Eric and Dylan drove out into the country, pulled onto a gravel strip, and got out to break stuff. There was a van parked there, with lots of electronic gizmos inside. How cool would it be to steal it? The boys had no idea what they might use the stuff for, but they were sure they could get away with it. No witnesses and no fingerprints. Eric had a pair of ski gloves to mask detection. Everything seemed so easy, he wrote later. No way we would get caught. Eric took guard duty and gave Dylan the dirty work. Dylan put one ski glove on and tried to punch out a window. They had no idea how solid a car window was. He hit it again and again. Nothing. Eric took over, just as useless. Dylan went for a rock. He hauled up a boulder, hurled it onto the glass, and even that was deflected. It took several blows before the rock crashed through. Dylan put the other glove on, reached in to unlock the door, and started digging through the pile like crazy. Eric again left Dylan to commit the act. He ran back to man the getaway car. Dylan grabbed anything that looked interesting. He flung everything else all over the van. By his count, he nabbed one briefcase, one black pouch, one flashlight, a yellow thing, and a bucket of stuff. Dylan ran armloads of loot back to the Honda. Eric continued to guard. Another car approached. Dylan froze. The car passed. Unfazed, Dylan ran back to grab more. Eric had grown wary. "That's enough," he ordered. "Let's go." They drove deeper into the country over the Hogback to Deer Creek Canyon Park, a vast preserve that ran for miles up into the mountains. The park was deserted. It closed an hour after nightfall, and the sun had set 4 hours ago. They pulled into the parking lot, killed the engine, and checked out the take. They cranked some tunes to enjoy themselves, then flipped on the dome light to hunt for another CD. Dylan reached back and hauled out his favorite item, a $400 voltmeter, the yellow thing with buttons along the base and black and red probes hanging off it. Dylan poked at the buttons. Eric watched intently. When the meter lit up, the boys went wild. "Cool!" Dylan pulled out the flashlight and switched it on. "Wow!" Eric howled. "That is really bright." Then he spotted something cooler. "Hey, we've got a Nintendo gamepad." They rummaged a bit more before Eric realized they had grown sloppy. "Time to resume precautions. We better put this stuff in the trunk," he said. He popped the latch and stepped out. That's when Jeffco Sheriff's deputy, Timothy Walsh, decided to make his presence known. He had been standing outside the car for several minutes, watching and listening to the entire exchange. You can see for miles out in the country, a lone vehicle in an empty lot in a closed state park just asked for intervention. The boys had been so immersed, they'd failed to see his car, hear his engine or his footsteps, or notice his tall frame looming right over the rear window. When Eric stepped out, Deputy Walsh blinded him with a flashlight beam. "What were they up to?" the deputy asked. "Whose property was all this?" "Right then I realized what a damn fool I was," Eric wrote later. He would claim remorse, but he didn't show any, even then. Eric thought fast, but lied poorly. He was off his game that night. He said they had been messing around in a parking lot near town and had stumbled onto the equipment stacked neatly in the grass. He gave a precise location and described it vividly. Details were the key to a good lie. Good tactics, bad choice. He depicted the actual robbery location. Walsh was incredulous. He asked to see the property. "Sure," Eric said. He kept playing it cool. He kept doing the talking. Dylan shut up and went along. Walsh had the boys stack the goods on the trunk and tried again. "Where did you find this property?" Dylan summoned up his nerve. He parroted Eric's story. Walsh said it looked suspicious. He would radio another deputy to check on any break-ins. Eric was confident. He looked over at his partner. Dylan folded. Wayne and Kathy Harris were waiting when Eric arrived at the police station. Tom and Sue Klebold were close behind. They couldn't believe their boys could do something like this. The boys could be charged with 3 felonies, including a Class 5, which carried up to a $100,000 fine and 1 to 3 years in prison. Eric and Dylan were questioned separately. With their parents' consent, they waived their rights. Each boy gave oral and written statements. Eric blamed Dylan. "Dylan suggested that we should steal some of the objects in the white van," he wrote. "At first, I was very uncomfortable and questioning with the thought." His verbal account was more adamant. He said Dylan looked into the van and asked, "Should we break into it and steal it? It would be nice to steal some stuff in there. Should we do it?" Eric claimed he responded, "Hell no." He said Dylan kept pestering him and eventually wore him down. Dylan accepted joint blame. "Almost at the same time, we both got the idea of breaking into this white van," he said. The boys were taken to county jail. They were fingerprinted, photographed, and booked. Then they were released into the custody of 4 furious parents. 36. Conspiracy. After the murders, the detective team sought convictions. It had 3 possible crimes to uncover: participation in the attack, participation in the planning, or guilty knowledge. At first, it looked easy. The killers had been sloppy. They hadn't even tried to cover their tracks. And the primary living suspects were juveniles. Most of the friends had withheld something crucial. Robin had helped purchase 3 of the guns. Chris and Nate had seen pipe bombs. And Chris and Zach had heard about napalm. They all broke quickly. They were kids. It was easy. But they broke only so far. They admitted to knowing details, but claimed to be clueless about the plan. Detectives pushed harder. The suspects didn't push back. They just threw up their hands. Fuselier had several solid agents on the case. He knew they could sniff out a liar. "How were the suspects responding?" he asked. "Do they seem deceptive?" "Not at all." His team leader described them as wide-eyed and understandably anxious. Most had begun by hiding something, and it had been painfully obvious. They were awful actors. But once they spilled it, they just seemed relieved. They were calm, peaceful, all the signs of someone coming clean. Most of the suspects agreed to polygraphs. That usually meant they had nothing left to hide. Two friends, Robert Perry and Joe Stair, had been identified by witnesses as shooters, or at least present at the scene. They were both tall and lanky, and therefore matched a common description for Dylan. Both boys produced alibis. Perry's was shaky. He had been sleeping downstairs until his grandmother woke him with news of the shooting. He said he walked upstairs, stumbled onto the porch, and cried. Did anyone see him other than his grandmother? No, he didn't think so. But Perry had been seen by others. He'd just been too upset to notice them. Within a week, a neighbor who was interviewed described driving up around noon and seeing Perry crying just the way he'd described. The physical evidence was even less damning. All the friends' houses were searched. No weapons were found. No ammo, no ordnance, no refuse of any pipe bomb assembly. Zack had a copy of the Anarchist Cookbook, but there was no sign that he had used it to build anything. Fingerprints at the crime scene were all a bust. There was an extraordinary amount of material: guns, ammo, gear, unused pipe bombs, strips of duct tape, and dozens of components from the big bombs. All of it was covered with the killer's prints, nobody else's. The same was true with the killer's houses. Nothing on the journals, videotapes, camcorders, or bomb assembly gear. No one appeared in the killer's records. Eric had been a meticulous planner and recorder of dates, locations, and receipts. Detectives searched the store's files and credit card records. All signs indicated that the killers had purchased everything. For months, Sheriff Stone publicly espoused a conspiracy theory. Fuselier could feel the conspiracy slipping away the first week. Within two, he knew it was remote. The most telling evidence came from the killers themselves. In their journals and videos, they copped to everything. They never mention outside involvement, except derisively, when they talk about hapless dupes. The killers leaked their plans in countless ways, but there's no indication that anyone close to them ever breathed the word. Their friends' emails, IMs, day planners, and journals were searched, along with every paper the investigators could find. There was no sign that any of the friends had known. Rumors about a third shooter have continued right up to the present day, but publicly, it didn't take long for investigators to put them to rest. Eric and Dylan were correctly identified by witnesses who knew them. No one else turned up on the surveillance videos or the 911 audio. Witnesses' accounts were remarkably consistent about a tall shooter and a short one. But there seemed to be two of each, two in T-shirts and two in trench coats. As soon as I learned Eric's coat was left outside on the landing, I knew what had happened there, Fuselier said. Witnesses exchanged stories, and reports of two guys in T-shirts and two in trench coats quickly turned into four shooters. Dylan's decision to leave his coat on until he reached the library made for more combinations, and the number multiplied over the afternoon. The killers also lobbed pipe bombs in every direction. Their gunfire shattered windows and ricocheted off walls, ductwork, and stairs. Many kids heard crashes or explosions and positively identified the location as the source of activity rather than the destination. Several witnesses insisted that they had spotted a gunman on the roof. What they had seen was a maintenance man adjusting the air conditioning unit. So what accounted for all the confusion? Eyewitness testimony in general is not very accurate, one investigator explained. Put that together with gunshots going off and just the most terrifying situation in their life, what they remember now may not be anywhere near what really happened. Human memory can be erratic. We tend to record fragments, gunshots, explosions, trench coats, terror, sirens, screams. Images come back jumbled, but we crave coherence, so we trim them, adjust details, and assemble everything together in a story that makes sense. We record vivid details, like the scraggly ponytail flapping against the dirty blue t-shirt of the boy fleeing just ahead. All the way out of the building, a witness may focus on that swishing hair. Later, she remembers a glimpse of the killer. He was tall and lanky. Did he have scraggly hair? It fits together, and she connects it. Soon, the killer is wearing the dirty blue t-shirt as well. Moments later, and forever after, she is convinced that's exactly what she saw. Investigators identified nearly a dozen common misperceptions among library survivors. Distortion of time was rampant, particularly chronology. Witnesses recalled less once the killers approached them, not more. Terror stops the brain from forming new memories. A staggering number insisted they were the last ones out of the library. Once they were out, it was over. Similarly, most of those injured, even superficially, believed they were the last ones hit. Survivors also clung to reassuring concepts that they were actually hiding by crouching under tables in plain sight. Memory is notoriously unreliable. It happens even with the best witnesses. 6 years later, Principal DeAngelis described the shooting as if he had just experienced it. He retraced his steps through the building, pausing at the exact spot where he first saw Dylan Klebold fire his shotgun. Mr. D pointed out Dylan's position and described everything Dylan was wearing, white t-shirt, military harness, ball cap turned around backward. But he has two entirely different versions of how he got there. In one version, he learned of the shooting in his office. That was unusual. Normally, he would have been in the midst of the cafeteria hubbub. But Tuesday, he was held up by an appointment. He had a meeting with a young teacher working on a one-year contract. Mr. D had been happy with the teacher's performance and was about to offer him a permanent position. They had just shaken hands and sat down when Frank's secretary's face slammed into the glass on the top half of his door. She had run to warn him so frantically that she'd failed to turn the knob completely and had hurtled right into the door. A moment later, she burst in shouting, "Frank, they're shooting!" "What? Gunshots downstairs! There are gunshots!" He bolted up. They ran out together into the main foyer, just past the huge hanging trophy case. Dylan fired, and the case shattered behind Frank. It was 2 or 3 years after the fact that Frank's secretary recounted that version for him. He told her she was nuts. He had no memory of that. "In my version, I'm walking out calmly, going to lunch," he said. "We finish the meeting. I've offered him the job. He's happy." DeAngelis had planned to offer the job. He liked the teacher and had pictured his joyful acceptance. Mentally, it had already happened. The actual events, gunfire in the hallway, his charge toward the girls' gym class, and the desperation to hide them, wiped out everything in his mental vicinity. His secretary's appearance was unimportant, and it conflicted with his memory of offering the job. One memory had to go. Mr. D checked with the teacher. No job offer. They'd just sat down. Other witnesses had seen him run alongside his secretary. He came to accept that version of the truth, but he can't picture it. His visual brain insists that the false memory is real. Multiply that by nearly 2,000 kids and over 100 teachers, and a precisely accurate picture was impossible to render. Investigators went back to interview the killer's closest friends several times. Each new interview and lead would raise more questions about the killer's associates. Sometimes new evidence revealed lies. An FBI agent interviewed Christy Epling the day after the murders. Christy was connected to both killers, particularly Eric. They were close, and she was dating his buddy, Nate Dykeman. She didn't seem to know much, though. Her FBI report was brief and unremarkable. She said Nate was in shock, the TCM connection was silly, and Eric had probably been the leader. Christy did not mention any of his notes in her possession. Like most of the killer's friends, Christy was exceptionally smart. She was headed to college on an academic scholarship. She played it cool about the notes during her FBI interview, then mailed them to a friend in St. Louis who was unconnected to Columbine and unlikely to be questioned. Christie was careful. No return address on the envelope. The friend went to the police. She did not inform Christie. The pages included notes passed back and forth between Christie and Eric in German class, a rambling conversation conducted in German. They mentioned a hit list. That was old news to investigators. Most of the school was on one of Eric's lists. But they had withheld that information from the public. Christie had been hiding it. Maybe she was hiding more. Detectives returned to question her. They asked about German class, and Christie said she had exchanged notes with Eric, but had thrown them away months ago. She assured them repeatedly that Eric had never made any threats. She would have told the teacher, she insisted. Christie also said Nate had fled to Florida to stay with his father and avoid the media hounds. They had talked on the phone that morning. The detectives asked Christie what should happen to someone who had helped the killers. They should go to jail forever, she said. It was a horrible thing. And what about someone who withheld information after the attack? I don't know, Christie said. It would depend on what it was. They should probably get counseling, she suggested, but some sort of punishment, too. They asked again, did she know anything more? No. Had she destroyed any notes from Eric? No. They kept repeating the questions, assuring her that she could disclose anything now, without repercussions. No, there was nothing. They continued questioning her, repeated that offer, and finally, she went for it. Okay, there were notes, she admitted. And Nate was not in Florida. He was staying with her. He was there in the house right now. She said the notes had been painful to hold on to, but she did not want to destroy them. If she could just get them somewhere far, far away, she hoped to retrieve them someday when everything was more clear. Once she copped to the truth, Christie was forthcoming. She agreed to turn over her PC and her email accounts and to take a polygraph. Beyond that, she didn't know anything significant. She told them about some things Nate had confessed to, but detectives knew about them already. Christie had just been afraid. She'd thought she had something incriminating, and she'd panicked. No evidence of a conspiracy. Another dead end. Nevertheless, Dr. Fuselier learned a great deal from the German conversation. It revolved around Christie's new boyfriend. She'd had a short-lived romance with a sophomore named Dan. Eric couldn't believe she was going out with that little fuck. Why? What was wrong with Dan? She asked. For one thing, the pretty boy had punched him in the face last year, Eric said. Eric in a fist fight? That surprised her. He always seemed so rational. He got mad when kids made fun of his black clothes or all his German crap, but he always kept his cool. He would calmly figure out how to get even. Christie worried about Eric getting even. She asked her boyfriend about it, and he said he was afraid Eric might kill him. Christie decided to play peace broker. She took it up with Eric in German class again. She told him straight out how scared Dan was. She used the phrase, kill him. That made Eric nervous. He was in the juvenile diversion program because of the van break-in, and threats like that could get him in trouble. Christie said she'd be careful about it. But how could Dan make it up to him? How about if he let me punch him in the face? Eric suggested. Seriously? Seriously. Dr. Fuselier was not surprised by the notes. Very cold-blooded. Any kid could get in a fight. Dan had gotten really angry, and in the heat of a fist fight, had clocked Eric. Eric was planning his punch. He wanted Dan to stand there defenseless and let him do it. Complete power over the kid. That's what Eric craved. As the conspiracy theory crumbled, far from the eyes of the public, a new motive emerged. The jock feud theory was accepted as the underlying driver. But that had supposedly gone on for a year. What made the killers snap? 9 days after the murders, the media found yet another trigger. The Marines. The New York Times and the Washington Post broke the story on April 29th. The rest of the media piled on quickly. They learned that Eric had been talking to a Marine recruiter during the last few weeks of his life. They also discovered he'd been taking the prescription antidepressant Luvox, something that would typically disqualify him because it implied depression. A Defense Department spokesman verified that the recruiter had learned about the medication and rejected Eric. The media was off to the races again. Luvox added an extra wrinkle as it functioned as an anger suppressant. The Times cited unnamed friends of Eric's as saying that they believed that he may have tried to stop taking the drug, perhaps because of his rejection by the Marines, 5 days before he and his best friend Dylan Klebold stormed into the Columbine campus with guns and bombs. The story added a bit of evidence that seemed to confirm it. The coroner's office said no drugs or alcohol had been found in Mr. Harris's body in an autopsy, but it would not specify whether the body had been screened for Luvox. It was finally coming together. The Marines rejected Eric. He quit the Luvox to fuel his rage. He grabbed a gun and started killing. It all fit. Fuselier read the stories. He shuddered. All the conclusions were reasonable and wrong. Eric's body had not initially been screened for Luvox. Later, it had. He'd remained on a full dose right up to his death. And investigators had talked to the Marine recruiter the morning after the murders. He had determined Eric was ineligible, but Eric had never known. By this time, Fuselier had already read Eric's journal and seen the basement tapes. He knew what the media did not. There had been no trigger. April 30th, officials met with the Klebolds and several attorneys to discuss ground rules for a series of interviews. Kate Batten was aggravated that she could not question the family directly, so she asked them to tell her about their son. They were still dumbfounded. They described a normal teenage boy, extraordinarily shy, but happy. Dylan was coping well with adolescence and developing into a responsible young adult. They entrusted him with major decisions when he could articulate his rationale. Teachers loved him, and so did other kids. He was gentle and sensitive until the day he died. Sue could recall seeing Dylan cry only once. He came home from school upset and went to his room. He pulled a box of stuffed animals out of the closet, dumped them out, burrowed under, and fell asleep surrounded. He never did reveal what disturbed him. His parents granted Dylan a measure of privacy in his own room. The last time Tom recalled being in there was about 2 weeks before the murders to turn off the computer Dylan left on. Otherwise, they monitored Dylan's life aggressively and forbade him from hanging out with bad influences. Tom said he was extremely close to Dylan. They shared Rockies season tickets with three other families, and on his nights, Tom usually took one of his sons. Tom and Dylan hung out all the time together. They played a lot of sports until Tom developed arthritis in the mid-1990s. Now it was a lot of chess, computers, and working on Dylan's BMW. They built a set of custom speakers together. Dylan didn't like doing repair work with Tom, though, and sometimes he got testy and snapped off one-word responses. That was normal. Tom considered Dylan his best friend. Dylan had a handful of tight buddies, his parents said. Zach and Nate, and, of course, Eric, who was definitely closest. Chris Morris seemed like more of an acquaintance. Dylan had fun with Robin Anderson, a sweet girl, but definitely nothing romantic. He hadn't had a girlfriend yet, but he had been kind of group dating. His friends seemed happy. They sure did laugh a lot. They were always polite and seemed laid back. Pretty immune to social pressure, they said. Eric was the quietest of the group. Tom and Sue never felt they knew what was going on in that head. Eric was always respectful, though. They were aware Judy Brown had a different opinion. Judy doesn't like a lot of people, Sue said. Tom and Sue didn't perceive Eric to be leading or following their son, but they did notice that he got angry at Dylan when he screwed something up. Before they left, detectives asked the Klebolds if they had any questions. Yes. They asked to read anything Dylan had written, anything to understand. Batten felt frustrated. I didn't get to ask any questions, she said later. All I got was a fluff piece on their son. She documented the interview, which remained sealed for 18 months. The series of interviews never occurred. Lawyers demanded immunity from prosecution before they would talk. Jeffco officials refused. The Harrises took the same position. Batten didn't even get a fluff piece from them. While Batten interviewed the Klebolds, the National Rifle Association convened in Denver. It was a ghastly coincidence. Mayor Wellington Webb begged the group to cancel its annual convention, scheduled long before. Angry barbs had flown back and forth all week. "We don't want you here," Mayor Webb finally said. Other promoters gave in to similar demands. Marilyn Manson had been incorrectly linked to the Killers. He canceled his concert at Red Rocks and the remainder of his national tour. The NRA show went on. 4,000 attended. 3,000 protesters met them. They massed on the Capitol steps, marched to the convention site, and formed a human chain around the Adams Mark Hotel. Many waved "Shame on the NRA" signs. One placard was different. Tom Mauser said, "My son Daniel died at Columbine. He'd expect me to be here today." Tom was a shy, quiet man. It had been a rough week, and friends weren't sure he was up to public confrontation. "He had a tough day yesterday," one coworker said. But Tom drew a deep breath, let it out, and addressed the crowd. "Something is wrong in this country when a child can grab a gun so easily and shoot a bullet into the middle of a child's face," he said. He urged them not to let Daniel's death be in vain. Tom had been struck by another coincidence. In early April, Daniel had taken an interest in gun control and had come to his father with a question. Did Tom know there were loopholes in the Brady Bill? Gun shows were excluded from the mandatory background checks. 2 weeks later, Daniel was murdered by a gun acquired at one of those shows. "Clearly, it was a sign to me," Tom explained later. Critics had already blasted Tom for profiting off his son's murder or getting duped by gun control activists. "I assure you, I am not being exploited," he told the crowd. Inside the Adams Mark, NRA President Charlton Heston opened the show. He went straight at Mayor Webb. The crowd booed. "Get out of our country, Wellington Webb," someone yelled. Conventioneers were amused. Heston charged on. "They say, don't come here," he said. "I guess what saddens me most is how it suggests complicity. It implies that you and I and 80 million honest gun owners are somehow to blame, that we don't care as much as they, or that we don't deserve to be as shocked and horrified as every other soul in America mourning for the people of Littleton. Don't come here? That's offensive. It's also absurd." The group observed a moment of silence for the Columbine victims. It then proceeded with the welcome ceremony. Traditionally, the oldest and youngest attendees are officially recognized at that time. The youngest is typically a child. Given the unusual circumstances, Heston announced that the tradition would be suspended this year. When the conspiracy evaporated, it left a dangerous vacuum. Dr. Fusilier saw the danger early on. "Once we understood there was no third shooter, I realized that for everyone, it was going to be difficult to get closure," he said. The final act of the Killers was among their cruelest. They deprived the survivors of a living perpetrator. They deprived the families of a focus for their anger and their blame. There would be no cathartic trial for the victims. There was no killer to rebuke in a courtroom, no judge to implore to impose the maximum penalty. South Jeffco was seething with anger, and it would be deprived of a reasonable target. Displaced anger would riddle the community for years. The crumbling conspiracy eliminated the primary mission of the task force. The all-star team was left to sort out logistical issues, exactly what had happened and how. Those were massive investigations, easy to get lost inside. Investigators wanted to retrace every step, reconstruct each moment, place every witness and every buckshot fragment in place and time and context. It was a Herculean effort, and it drew the team's attention from the real objective. Why? The families wanted to know how their children died, of course, But that was nothing compared to the underlying question. Early on, officials began to say the report would steer clear of conclusions. "We deal with facts," Division Chief Kickbush said. "We'll make a diligent effort not to include a bunch of conclusions. Here are the facts. You read it and make your own conclusions." The families were incredulous. So was the press. Make our own conclusions? How many civilians felt qualified to diagnose mass murderers? Isn't that what homicide detectives were for? The public was under the impression that 100 of them had been paid for months to perform that service. Of course, homicide teams draw conclusions. What Kickbush meant was that they avoid discussing those conclusions externally. That's the DA's role. The cops develop the case, but the DA presents it to the jury and to the public as necessary. But aside from the gun providers, there was no one to try for the Columbine killings. Sheriff Stone kept talking up the conspiracy theory with the press. He was driving his team nuts. They had all but ruled it out. Every few days, Jeffco's spokesman corrected another misstatement by the sheriff. Several corrections were extreme. Arrests were not imminent. Deputies had not blocked the killers from escaping the school. And Stone's description of the cafeteria videos had been pure conjecture. The tapes had not even been analyzed yet. They did not try to correct some of his mischaracterizations, like when he quoted Eric's journal out of context to give the impression that the killers had been planning to hijack a plane when they'd started their attack. He was quickly becoming a laughingstock, yet he was the ultimate ranking authority on the case. His staff begged him to stop speaking to the press, but how would it look if subordinates spoke about the case while the head man was muzzled? A tacit understanding developed on the team. If Stone kept his mouth shut, they would too. Though they continued background interviews with the Rocky. For the next 5 months, until an impromptu interview by lead investigator Kate Batten in September, law enforcement officers would divulge virtually nothing more publicly about their discoveries or conclusions. After that, it would be a slow trickle and a fight for every scrap of information. 9 days after the shootings, the Jeffco blackout began. Columbine coverage ended abruptly, too. A string of deadly tornadoes hit Oklahoma, and the National Press Corps left town in a single afternoon. The school would return periodically to national headlines over the years, but the narrative of what had happened was set. 37. Betrayed. Eric needed professional help. His father made that determination within 48 hours of his arrest. Wayne picked up the steno pad that had sat idle for 9 months and began filling half a dozen pages. "See psychologist," he wrote. "See what's going on. Determine treatment." Wayne gathered names and numbers for several agencies and services and added bulleted items to them. Anger management, life management, professional therapist, mental health center, school counselor, juvenile assessment center, and family adolescent team. Wayne documented several conversations with lawyers. He wrote probation, circled it, and added, "Take any chances for reformation or diversion." Wayne checked out half a dozen candidates for therapist. Their rates varied from 100 to 150 per hour. He settled on Dr. Kevin Albert, a psychiatrist, and made an appointment for February 16th. Wayne logged page after page of calls to cops, lawyers, and prosecutors, working through their options. The juvenile diversion program sounded ideal. A year of counseling and community service, along with fines, fees, and restitution. If Eric completed it successfully and kept clean for an additional year, the robbery would be expunged from his record. But the DA's office had to accept him. Eric told Dr. Albert he had anger problems. Depression was an issue. He had contemplated suicide. He apparently did not mention the bombs he took to the park the previous evening. Dr. Albert started him on Zoloft, a prescription antidepressant. Eric continued meeting with him biweekly, and Wayne and Kathy began occasional sessions as well. At home, the boys received similar punishments. Each was grounded for a month and forbidden contact with the other. Eric also had his computer access revoked. He went to work on his pipe bombs. He lost one, or perhaps left it as a warning or clue. On February 15th, the day before Eric's first appointment with Dr. Albert, someone in the neighborhood stumbled upon his work, a duct-taped PVC pipe in the grass with a red fuse protruding. Kind of an odd sight for a suburban park in Jeffco. The Jeffco cops sent out an investigator from the bomb squad. Sure enough, it was a homemade pipe bomb. Officers didn't find a whole lot of those around here. The investigator defused the bomb and filed a report. Eric and Dylan hid their arrest from friends. They made excuses about their restrictions. Finally, they began to come clean. Eric fessed up to a girl at Blackjack, and word traveled to Nate Dykeman. Nate couldn't believe Dylan had been hiding it from him. "Is this the reason you can't go out?" Nate asked. Dylan turned red. "He didn't want to talk about it," Nate said later. After word leaked, Eric told friends it was the most embarrassing moment of his life. Both boys were humiliated, and Eric was raging mad. Dylan's response was more complex. 3 days after his arrest, Dylan pictured himself on the road to happiness with Harriet. He sketched it out in his journal as a two-lane highway with a road sign off one shoulder and a dashed stripe down the center. His road led off to a majestic row of mountains with a giant heart guiding him onward. "It's so great to love," he wrote. He was a felon now, but he was ecstatic. He filled half the page with drawings and exclamations. "I love her, and she loves me." Anger boiled up with the ecstasy. Dylan was beginning to see it Eric's way. "The real people, gods, are slaves to the majority of zombies, but we know and love being superior. Either I'll commit suicide or I'll get with Harriet, and it will be NBK for us. My happiness, her happiness, nothing else matters." Suicide or murder? The pattern solidified, homicidal thoughts occasionally, self-destruction on every page. "If by love's choice Harriet didn't love me, I'd slit my wrist and blow up Atlanta strapped to my neck," he wrote. Eric had named one of his pipe bombs Atlanta. Wayne Harris kept working the phones. By early March, he secured an evaluation with Andrea Sanchez, a counselor with a juvenile diversion program. Sanchez placed calls to Eric and Dylan to pre-screen them. They passed. She sent a dozen forms and set up appointments. Each boy would come to her office with a parent and the stack of paperwork. Both intake sessions would take place on March 19th. For 2 months, Wayne Harris worked to get his son into diversion, to keep his record clean. Eric was busy too. He was detonating his first pipe bombs. He boldly posted the breakthrough on his website. "Motherfucker blew big. Flippin' thing was heart-pounding, gut-wrenching, brain-twitching, ground-moving, insanely cool. His brothers haven't found a target yet, though."